All right, we've got Delaware County-based farmer Tiana Kennedy on the phone, who's been busy during the winter visiting Washington, D.C. and Albany, talking to legislators about farming issues. Tiana, are you there?
Yes, I am.
So you went to Washington, D.C. first? Is that what happened?
Yes, I was flown out to Washington, D.C. by National Sustainable Agricultural Council, and we did some lobbying with Faso, Maloney, and Gillibrand there. And then the week following week, we went to Albany with the National Young Farmers Coalition and the Farm Bureau, and we did more lobbying there. We split into two groups, but I met with Senator Pamela Helming, Eileen Gunter, the Office Assembly Member William McGee, Office Assembly Member James Skoufis, Office Assembly Member Kerry Werner, and then Al Stripes, Steve Englebright, Thomas O'Mara, James Seward, and David Velasquez. It was a very busy day that day.
And just tell us first, what kind of farmer are you?
Oh, I am a vegetable farmer in Delaware County. I've been here for about 8 years. I started farming for someone else, and then started my own farm with my farm partner, Walter Reason, about 5 years ago. So we run a CSA, a 200-person CSA that goes to the city. We have 12 spots in the city, and we also work with restaurants, both upstate and downstate. So we have about 17 restaurant accounts, and so it's a pretty intense production.
And the website is starroutefarm.com or something like that?
Yeah, Star Route Farm. And then the CSA is the 607 CSA, which is we're looking for members right now. So if you guys know anybody interested in veggies, actually that's a full diet CSA. It's a multi-farm CSA that we started. So we work with 10 farms and have, you know, anything you could possibly imagine. Meat pies and beef broth and cheese and dairy and eggs and whatever you can add on to the CSA in the city.
And that's 10 different farms in Delaware County?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's it's called the 607 because we are sourcing within the area code. So small family farms, and instead of each farm scaling up, we're just collaborating to bring stuff to the city.
And so when you first went to Washington, D.C., did you actually meet with Representative John Faso, or did you just talk to their staff, or you talked to him in person?
I talked to John. I talked to Faso himself.
He's a mysterious figure up here. We never know where he's going to be. He doesn't post on his website where he's going to be anymore.
I know. It's funny. As elusive as he is, I've met with him twice. We had a round table last fall as well.
That was in Columbia County too, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's because agriculture is something that is pretty nonpartisan. It's something that everybody's kind of trying to get behind. And so it's kind of a safe space to talk about stuff.
And he's on the agricultural committee too, right?
He is on the agricultural committee, yeah. And he's, you know, and he's working, he's collaborating with Democrats on the committee because the Northeast is sort of it's a minority in the committee where you have the, you know, huge sprawling Midwestern farms that kind of like eat up all the resources and stuff. So all of everybody that is interested in diversified farming or smaller scale farming has to work bipartisan, you know, like across the, they just to work together to get anything pushed through regionally rather than by party. So that's pretty cool.
And it seems like most often we hear about when agricultural issues come up in the news, it's mostly about dairy farms and dairy this and that. I'm guessing you didn't talk to him about that. You talked to him about other issues.
Right. The dairy farming industry is that has a lot of challenges right now, but basically, we were there for, there are all sorts of issues. This is a farm bill year, and that happens every 5 years or 5 to 7 years. And so right now, they're writing policy that will affect funding and programming for the next 7 years. And so it's kind of an important time. And in particular, like, this moment is really important because they're actually in the process of writing. So instead of just, like, going and having a token visit to say, I am a farmer that supports X and Y, and, like, having them, like, put a little hash mark in a column somewhere, this is their, it's sort of a brainstorming session. We're, like, trying to create policy right now. So the organizations that I'm working with are, like, co-writers, are writing policy that the representatives are sponsoring for the bill. So the policy that I was in support of in D.C. was about, there's about crop insurance and also about just supporting beginning farmers programming and legislation. So there's, like, a couple of bills that are kind of on the table for that. So I can talk about any of these.
Yeah, tell us why are those two things important?
Okay, well, the crop insurance thing is kind of, it's like weird minutia, but it's really kind of important because the way crop insurance works is often a county will have insurance policies on certain things. Like in Delaware County, you can only get crop insurance on hay. You can't get, like, if you're a farmer and even if you're farming corn and soybeans, there's not crop insurance available for those crops. So
For hay, you're worried it's going to get too moist and ruin or something?
Yeah, exactly. And so that makes it really difficult for people that are, you know, say you have a diversified vegetable farm and you get hailstorm or a flood and you lose everything. The only recourse is a non-insurable crop insurance emergency fund that the FSA runs, and that is based on conventional prices, and it's pennies to the dollar on what you would get if you had an actual policy. And also, each vegetable is its own enterprise. So the way that the current, like, so you do manage to get crop insurance, the way that it works right now is that you have to have incredible records for, like, every single, like, for strawberries and then for kale and then for whatever. It's like each one gets its own policy because in the way the rest of the country works, it's just monoculture. So it's really, you know, it's like I have 200 acres of, you know, cabbages that I need to insure. But when you're running these farms that many small family farms or beginning farms are running, there's no, like, crop agnostic whole farm protection that you can get. So
your farm doesn't have just apricots. You have all kinds of different things.
Exactly. We have, like, 145 different varieties of plants that we're growing. It's, like, logistically crazy. And then trying to keep records on all of it is also hard. So it disincentivizes farmers and also insurance agents to, like, solve these problems the way the current system is set up, because nobody wants to take the time. Insurance agents get money based on policy numbers, not, like, hours it takes them to write the policy, you know. So they're not interested in working with complicated farming structures like ours, and we're not interested in, like, all the record keeping that these things entail, and the money just isn't really worth it at the moment. So there's a group of people at Cornell and elsewhere that are trying to solve this problem. There's some policies out west in Oregon that are working, and I worked on a farm. I'm interested in this because I worked on a farm that was, like, taken out during Irene, and it almost went under. And it's this linchpin farm in our region that, like, makes all the other, that, like, trucks everything to the city and provides, aggregates resources for everybody. And if that farm goes, then we all go. So
this isn't just theoretical. This in 2011, this actually happened
exactly
to local farmers. And so,
yeah.
So they only could get pennies on the dollar for their losses then?
Exactly. Yeah. So we had to just, like, figure it out, bootstrap it, and be creative business people, which is, like, what farmers do anyway. But it would be really nice to, you know, the larger ag, it also works sort of as a subsidy. Like, people use these insurance claims as, like, subsidies out west. And there's no help for either new farms or diversified family farms, you know, like old-fashioned farms. It's not even, like, a new idea. It's like farms used to have, you know, 40 pigs and some cattle and some vegetables, and, you know, and that sort of model isn't supported under the current, like, system that just supports, like, monocropping and big, you know. And also, for instance, if you are a monocrop you know, huge farm in the Midwest, it would still be helpful to have a different sort of insurance policy, because basically right now, if you're using any sort of sustainable measures like cover cropping or, I don't know, all of these things that would like enhance the quality of your soil and your plants, if your neighbor gets hit by the same, you know, systems, weather system that you do, and your farm survives because you've been doing all these progressive things that make your soil and your crops more resilient, then they're going to get the money and you're not. So there has to also be, you know, take like stewardship has to be taken into account and prioritized as well. So at any rate, those sorts of issues are being solved right now, but there's still a lot of work, and we're just urging that this farm bill maintains funds to keep this project alive. So there's no current solution that works for everybody, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done, and that requires funding. So I want to talk about that. That's one thing.
And the second thing was getting younger farmers involved?
Yeah, the second thing was the local and regional food, it's the Local Food and Regional Market Supply Act that's in the Farm Bill. And this does all sorts of things. It helps farmers reach new markets. It increases access to local food by dealing with value chain facilitation, which is like how people from like the middle of nowhere, like where I am, get food to market. So trucking, logistics, marketing, all of that stuff. It deals with, infrastructure. It does just all these things that like it helps like local regions set up food hubs so that the farms can collaborate better. So it's there's all sorts of sort of like co-project or underlying projects within this bill, this act that would help rural communities like reestablish market connections that have been lost in the last 20 years. So that one, and then there's like a Beginning Farmers and Ranchers Act that helps beginning farmers get access to land, access to capital, and you know taken seriously in USDA. And
it's hard to get started because you have to buy so many tractors and big ticket items.
Exactly. It's like farming is a really high risk business. It's basically like running a Toyota factory, but without a roof. You know, you have a production schedule, you have expectations, you have to meet them, but you're subject to all sorts of variables that you have very little control over, and more given the climate, you know, change, the issues that we're dealing with. And so traditional banks aren't likely to lend to people, especially if they have no background farming, or if they have no, don't have any business records because they're starting up. So farmers have to work with agencies, federal agencies like the FSA, in order to get funding to farm. And because right now is a really critical moment, because the average age of farmers is like 65 in the country, we need to encourage as many new and young farms as we can, and so we need to make sure that there's still access to this sort of startup capital that the federal government is putting aside for people.
And I guess so, to keep your Toyota metaphor, you also lack the branding of Toyota and the distribution
exactly.
network of Toyota, right?
Exactly. So that's what the Local Farms Act is helping with. And then the policy that I was like endorsing in Albany is a similar project. It's land access. Instead of access to capital, it's access to land, because right now, like I was saying, farmland is in transition, and even there's still a lot of land that people have already retired, but they're holding on to it. Farmers are holding on to it, but pretty soon there's huge swaths of farmland in this country are going to be transitioned. And the problem that's happening right now is even if you're progressive and you want to conserve the land and you want it to be saved as open space, you can get easements on it through land trusts or through various agencies. But the problem, and so there's been like $24 million set aside over the past 10 years or something to work on these easements. But the problem is the easements keep the land undeveloped, but they don't keep it in production, because when it goes to market, it gets sold at the same, at a retail market, you know, at a market value instead of an agricultural value. So farmers that aren't making money, they don't have margins, they have debt, they can't compete with second homeowners that want a view shed, they want like a beautiful property that they can hay, you know. So these
land trusts, that people can buy it to live on it, but they don't necessarily have to farm it.
Exactly.
They just can't develop it into a housing project or something.
Exactly. Or not develop it, but just keep it open as a gentleman's estate forever. But it, once it goes out of production, it's really hard to get back in production. And so in the Farmland for Farmers Act, we're trying to make a measure that in these easements, there's a little extra money set aside to buy the difference between market value and agricultural value also, so that and to prioritize farmers as the next group of people to buy the land, so that the next, you know, iteration of, or the next, when the land needs to be sold, the first choice is a farmer. And then if the farmer can't buy it, then, you know, then it can be sold to a second homeowner. But a farmer is prioritized and they can afford it. It's in their range because that extra value has also been bought when the easement was bought, so that they can buy it as, like, you know, for thousands of dollars cheaper.
And here in Greene County, there's a bunch of farmland that is being turned over to solar farms. Is that going on in Delaware County too?
Oh, not yet. No, but that's interesting.
Yeah, these large industrial-sized solar farms that we've got Not In My Backyard people protesting them in Coxsackie, and a lot of towns have passed moratoriums on solar farms to try to get regulations in place to regulate them, because at this point they're unregulated because the towns don't have laws set up for that sort of thing.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, no, that hasn't happened here right now. It's mostly just people coming up from there's been sort of a renaissance over here, so everybody has rediscovered the Catskills and is coming up and buying property up here. And the people that come up, it's not like they're villains or something. A lot of people that are coming up now are interested in agriculture and care, but they don't understand that they're part of the problem when they come up and can buy it out from under, you know, active working farms, because they come up and it's like gentleman farmers, there's like project farmers, there's gardeners, and so their whole livelihood isn't dependent on that income, and so they can, you know, they're operating in sort of like a fake economy. And so part of it is just like educating the people that are coming up and buying the land about, you know, and a lot of people also want to rent to farmers but don't quite understand what it means to have an active farm. So once a farmer moves in and it's messy and dirty and loud and people are there all the time and there's insurance, you know, there's liability questions they hadn't thought about, then, you know, then often those relationships sour and the farmers get kicked out. So part of it is just like an education thing, you know, like this is an issue, this is what's going on, here's how farms work, are you sure you really want one, you know, stuff like that. So, yeah. But also part of it is just making sure that the leveling the playing field so that farmers can afford to buy land in regions that have never been industrialized, that have always been in agriculture, that are like beautiful because of the agriculture, and are going to be like anywhere else once they're like subdivided and turned into like, you know, strip malls or whatever. So it's like, you know, preserving the cultural heritage, the agricultural economy, and the vibe, basically, by making sure that farmers can still exist in this region.
And you also spoke about some other issues like rural broadband.
Yeah, I just really lucked out. There happened to be a reporter from the, I can't remember now who, Daily News, I don't know, I can't remember who it was, in D.C. that was looking to interview somebody about rural broadband. And we have, where we are, I'm in the library in Worcester right now because I don't have internet at home. And it's, you know, we get satellite internet out here, but it's like so hard to get anyone to service it. So if it goes out, you're like out for a month. And when you do have it, they like put data caps on you. And it's just like, it really makes it impossible to compete in like a competitive marketing world when you can't use a video, you can't use audio, you can't use it because you don't have the bandwidth to like upload or download these things. You're just like you know, you're like in 1997, like, website world, you know, and even just communicating, like, doing management, it's all really difficult without internet. And there's no cell phone service out here either. So it's like you're just kind of stuck in the minute. So it's like the rural economy also really depends on being able to compete by having like access to, you know, communication and data and stuff like that.
And so what are the solutions for that?
Well, just, you know, the solutions, I think, are it doesn't make sense for the cable companies to go into these areas because they don't have, like, a density of users to, like, you know, make it worth their while to, like, lay all the cables, you know. So if there was some legislation or some subsidies for them to make sure that everybody was connected, then that would be helpful.
And have you been seeing that? I mean, in this area, in Columbia and Greene County, the local cable companies have been getting these New York State broadband grants to extend their service. Is that not happening in Delaware County?
I mean, I'm actually in Otsego County at the moment. I spent the last 7 years in Delaware County, but my farm's right on the border, and we're in Otsego. So I think Delaware County is there. In the 8 years that I've lived here, it's definitely increased its service, but we're just a little bit outside of that. We're like in no man's land out here, and so I've you know, call every couple of months and beg them, and they're like, nope, not gonna happen. So I don't know. I haven't like checked in with local politics to see if there's anybody pressuring them from this side, but definitely still don't have access. So it's maddening.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Delaware County farmer Tiana Kennedy, who recently went to Albany and Washington, D.C. to lobby politicians about agricultural issues. And you met with Representative John Faso. You said it's now the second time you've talked to him with him in person. So was he receptive to agricultural ideas, or what is he like as a politician?
Yeah, I mean, we talked with so many people and there was so many different levels of engagement. Like, Gillibrand's office was amazing. They were, like, complete problem solvers and, like, were just right in there with us, like, you know, and Maloney also was amazing. Faso was definitely engaged and definitely cared. He was more interested in talking about SNAP and the issues of, like, gutting SNAP in this farm bill than...
He was in favor of gutting food stamp?
No, no.
He was increasing...
He was just letting us know that he was in favor of, like, of leveraging that program to, you know, he definitely isn't in favor of that program and isn't threatening anybody to.
That's the food stamp program, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But his mind was there and like how to improve that and how to solve those problems, because I think it's sort of a contentious issue in the committee. So instead of, like, with everybody else, we were coming to talk about our issues, and with Faso, he was, like, talking with us about his issue that he's interested in. But
so was he trying to get you to say things to back up his previously held beliefs, or was he looking for new information?
I think he was trying to get us to like, endorse his perspective, which was easy, because we all want to keep it going, but he, and that only took a moment. He actually spent quite a good amount of time with us, maybe like 45 minutes or something. And so we did eventually get to talk about all these different ideas with him. And his staff was very supportive. I mean, he basically said he would definitely endorse all of these acts that we were interested in because it made sense for our region. And there was no pushback or just, you know, a couple of the offices we went to was just sort of like, you know, staring at, it felt like we were wasting time and they were just like waiting until we left. That was not the case at Paso's office. He himself was there. He was being called to session and he just ignored that to continue talking to us. So it's like, you know, there was like a lot going on while we were there, and he really was taking time out of a busy day to like meet with us and talk about these agricultural issues. So I have to say, in this instance, it was a very positive experience.
And you didn't call up yourself and schedule a visit. You were with a group, you were saying.
Correct. Yeah. In both of the instances, I was lucky to be working with with larger groups. So the DC fly-in was the National Sustainable Agricultural Council, and they are an organization that is sort of an umbrella organization and alliance of grassroots organizations that advocate for federal policy to reform to advance the sustainability of agricultural food systems and natural resources. So they operate nationally and at all scales and with all types of farms in order to just like endorse sustainable models and to make sure the policy supports that. And the other group that I was with was, so that was a really interesting plan because there was like 20 different farmers from all over the country and guys from Mississippi that were farming like a couple thousand acres, guys from, and we all got to hang out for a couple of days and talk about our different operations. And, some guy from Iowa that just had like a bunch of goats that he was grazing, like, invasive species with his goats. And that was his project. And so there was like a totally strange, diverse, awesome group of farmers there to meet. And that was really interesting. And then the other work that we were doing in Albany was with the National Young Farmers Coalition, who are based in Hudson. But they're also a national organization, and they're advocating for policy reform that supports new and beginning farmers. So, and that's any age group. It's just people that have been farming for 10 years or less.
And so you had better access than someone who just wanted to call up their representative in D.C. and say, I'd like to meet with you.
Totally. They have, both of these people have offices in D.C., or groups have offices in D.C., and they have people that work on policy and work very carefully with these staffers on other issues, and these guys are the guys that are writing the policy that goes into these bills that then get passed as law, and so they are taken seriously when they ask for fly-ins and for meetups and with a constituency, and so it's really useful to align yourself to some organization like that if you have an idea that you want to get across. But the thing, even above and beyond that. It was really interesting to see how responsive everybody I met with, and I met with like 13 different offices, were to their constituency. And I've never done this before. This is all new to me. And I sometimes took part in letter writing campaigns or phone, call-ins or whatever, but I always felt like you were just like a cog in a wheel and it was maybe useful or maybe not useful. But when you meet these people in person, they really care and they are really interested and it does inform their decisions. And if you, especially like, even if you say something that in the middle of a vote, 2 months later, they remember that phrase or whatever, then they'll vote for you. It's the same as if how any marketing works. If you're like, at the voting booth and you've maybe not done all of your homework, but you remember a couple of sound bites that you heard on whatever, then it's going to influence the way you vote so it works both ways. So, I would say it's definitely, definitely worthwhile to engage and to meet with your representatives and to form relationships, because I think you can affect change.
And was Albany much different than Washington, D.C., or was it similar experience?
Well, Albany was D.C. It was just me and the policy guy, and there was a little more pressure when I went to these meetings, and I really had to be on the ball. In Albany, we went with a group of farmers. So we went in with like four different farmers that represented different, like there's a livestock guy, a flower farmer, me, a vegetable farmer, and somebody else. And so we came in, and one guy was like a second generation farmer, and the others of us were like new farmers. So we came in and we told our stories about how it was difficult to access land where we were and what sort of like, struggles we still have and continue to face, and how renting is harder than owning for these various reasons. And so it was really nice to have like a group to like play off of and to that could fill in various points. And we did 10 meetings together. So by the end of the day, we were like a dog and pony show ready to go on the road. We like really knew each other's stories inside and out and could like play off each other to like be rhetorically, more, and potent, I guess, and we really, the staffers really responded well to the stories and to our like dynamic, and it felt really great. So I think going as a small group is more feels more effective than going alone. Because also you're more members of your constituency.
And Albany, I guess, I mean, D.C. is the common thing. Conventional wisdom now is that it's gridlocked, and Albany, the conventional wisdom, it's corrupt. Do you feel like you actually could make some change, or was it, kind of a waste of time?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard, and I guess that time will tell, right? We'll see how many of these actions, get passed, or even if they get to the Farm Bill this year, it also just felt totally crazy in D.C. Like, it was a lobby week, and there were people, it was like Halloween, there's like everybody from every delegate, every cause was like standing in line to go through the metal detectors. I mean, like, the guy in front of you is like a driller, and the guy behind you is like, looks like an Iranian Santa Claus, and there's somebody in a feather boa on a scooter. It was like very weird.
The village people
they're all going to do the same thing, to go talk to their representatives about their cause. And so in that, when you kind of took a step back, you felt like an ant in an ant, farm, and it was kind of weird. But then when you got into the meeting and you had these like face-to-face interactions, it felt pretty serious and pretty viable. So I don't know. Time will tell, I guess.
Do you have any advice if people are writing letters or phone calling or taking trips to D.C. or Albany, how they should approach legislators?
Well, I mean, it's helpful to have anecdotal stories to back up your ask. It's also helpful to be very clear about what your ask is. Please endorse, please, we recommend that you keep the $24 million that is currently in the budget for X, Y, and Z, please vote yes, and then you talk about stuff. Or we were lucky in this, like, in the Farmland for Farmers Act, it's not actually a financial ask, it's just asking for a change in the language and the policy, and stuff like that. So it's really helpful to be clear about what you want, and then to give some anecdotal storytelling about your experience or your friend's experience and how this would affect change in your life. And then just to be like pretty quick and succinct, because these guys don't have a lot of time. But I guess that's my advice.
All right. Any other thing you think you should mention about the experience?
The Albany one, like, I just got to D.C. and I have a farm to serve on, and I just moved as well, so I'm really, 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 really busy, and I was just like, oh, I can't believe I'm doing this again. What am I doing? I'm wasting time. And so that was the other useful thing about going with friends, because I went with two other farmers, and all three of us were just like, I do not have time for this today. I can't do this. But because we went together, we had each other. It's like going to the gym, you're like, well, I'll go if you go. So we all went, and at the end of the day, we were all very happy we went. We were like, this was actually a really super worthwhile thing to be doing, and especially right now, So, so it felt really good to engage. And, like, who knows if it's going to be heard in this current administration, but it's, for me, at least, it felt better to try than to just, like, sit back and in despair, I don't know. We'll see. Luckily, I'm dealing with policy that makes sense. It's like, it's not a faith-based thing or an issue, but, it's like, it's pretty, what we're asking for is pretty logical, and if anybody cares about agriculture or wants to treat, wants that to be part of our future, then the things we're asking for are really modest, and
so it's a logical issue, so it'll never get passed in D.C.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, what I was saying is, it's something that I feel like is easy to endorse, like, regardless of your political positioning,
I've just got one final question, not related to this issue. I'm wondering if Delaware County was overwhelmed by these East Asian stink bugs the way that Greene County was last fall and this winter.
No.
You do not?
Actually, that's not true. I have seen some. Yeah, that's weird. They have popped up a little bit more than... I don't think it's been a total...
It's not the huge agricultural menace that there's a large New Yorker story that makes it out to be a very large agricultural menace, that they don't have they eat everything and they don't have enemies here. They're thinking about importing these Asian bees or something that eat them, which would probably cause a whole nother.
Yeah, exactly. Well, not yet. Maybe that's this year's excitement for us.
Something to look forward to this year.
Exactly. The day of the locust. Yeah. All right.
All right. Tiana Kennedy, Delaware County Farmer, thank you for talking to us about your recent trip to D.C. and Albany to lobby legislators about agricultural issues.
Yeah. Thank you for taking the time to talk to me.